This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Peace, family. This episode was originally recorded on video. If you want to check out the images that go along with the conversation, then head over to youtube.com/@BLKShutter. Enjoy the episode.
The camera is a tool. It's an extension of you, of your thinking, because the eye is in control. My first mentor taught me that. Like, there's no camera or lens that can make a picture. Only your eye can make a picture. The camera is an extension. It can be anything. It can be a box camera. It can be an expensive camera. It can be an iPhone. It has nothing to do with what you see.
What's going on, y'all? You have just tuned in to the Black Shutter Podcast. On this show, I invite Black photographers, filmmakers, editors, and creative business folks to discuss their experiences and share their wisdom. You will hear about their work, their challenges, and their inspirations. My name is Idris Talib Solomon, a creative director, photographer, and filmmaker based in Brooklyn, New York. So if you dig photography and you love the culture, keep your mind open and your headphones locked. This is the Black Shutter Podcast. All right, welcome back to another episode of the Black Shutter Podcast. My name is Idris Talib Solomon. And today's guest, we have Mr. Chester Higgins Jr. Chester, welcome to the Black Shutter Podcast. How you feeling out there, bro?
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm feeling good. I'm just trying to age gracefully.
Indeed.
I'll be 78 pretty soon.
Wow. Wow. It doesn't look it, man. I would say that you are aging gracefully. And I just look forward to hearing about your work and your career. And you know, one thing that I know about you is that you really appreciate the quality of light, you know? So I definitely want to dig into that and also how you connect spirit to your work, right? But before we get into that, you know, I know that you have been a staff photographer for the New York Times for over 4 decades. I know that your work is featured in a permanent collection of MoMA, the Modern Museum of Modern Art, you know, and this stat right here is really, really amazing that you've been to the African continent over 50 times. And in the words of Lonnie Bunch, he's quoted as saying, Chester Higgins is capturing an Africa that has a spirit of hope, of possibility that in some ways he believes will shape the African-American experience as well. And back in 2022, you were inducted into the International Photography Hall of Fame Museum. I didn't even know that existed, but congratulations on that.
I don't know. I guess, first of all, I must tell you that I'm from a little country town in Alabama of 800 mm-hmm. people, a little village. Mm-hmm. And people grew cotton and peanuts. Mm-hmm. And I had very formative and close relationships with my great aunts and uncles. Who all lived to die after 95. The oldest one was 108. And I went to a school called Tuskegee.
Wow.
My great uncle, March 4th, died at 108. And at Tuskegee, while I was studying business, I had the fortunate experience of running into this old photographer named P.H. Polk. Mm-hmm. And one day at his house, he has some pictures hidden behind a curtain. And I saw these pictures and it reminded me of my great aunts and uncles. They were pictures made during the depressions of farmers dressed, you know, in their coveralls or in their, you know, assortments of fabric, but very dignified. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me of my great uncle March 4th and his sister, my great aunt Shug Lampley, who was a midwife. And it made me think that, wow, they look like this. But, you know, photographs were very expensive things to have done. First of all, in the South, racist South, you would not be going to a white photographer's studio, just like you don't go to a white dentist. And I wanted to have pictures. I wanted to, my great aunt and uncle, who only had a picture on their wall of Jesus Christ and then a farmer's almanac. I wanted them to feel the sense of agency of seeing themselves on their wall. And I couldn't hire, didn't have the money on a student budget to hire this photographer to go south 90 miles and make these pictures. So I asked him if he would teach me. A year and a half later, I'm learning, just mostly conversating with him where he demystified the process of photography, of dealing with people. I finally bought a good camera, a Nikomat, and had a light meter. And I went south. I went home to photograph one weekend my relatives. Then came back, and Mr. Polk paid him to process the film and make the prints. And then I got a frame, and I went back another weekend to take them the pictures and put them on the wall because I wanted to see their eyes focus on those pictures. And I wanted to see their heart smile that they were worthy of being on their wall with the other two things that they thought were worthy. So that's the reason I picked up the camera, for my love of my relatives. But getting back to college, the civil rights movement was going, and, we as students would go over, take a bus, the university would rent a bus, and we would go over to Montgomery and we would picket George Wallace. And I noticed for the first time, not that I hadn't noticed it before, but we become inured to it, these racist images of us in the paper. Because in the media, the only time you saw images of Black folks in the South, they were either suspected felons or prostitutes. Or suspected prostitutes. So the next day in the paper and that evening in the television news, we were not seen as American citizens petitioning in our government. We were seen as potential thugs, arsonists, and rapists. So it taught me two things. It taught me that I had learned, we all had learned, to ignore the least common denominator images of us that white people prefer. But it also taught me that a camera never lies about the photographer. If the photographer is a person who hates you, there's no way you're going to get a good picture out of that person. If the photographer is a person who loves you, there's no way you're going to get a bad picture out of that person. So it taught me the power not only of the camera, the effect that the image has, but the effect of the person who's wielding it. So I took that to feel that I had a choice. I could either take a apply card and walk out in front of the television station or the newspaper and say, you guys are racist, or I can learn how to make the pictures that they cannot see and go over them to go to find a larger audience. And that larger audience was what was coming out of the New York press, to leapfrog over them. Because I wanted my images to be on the world stage so that it becomes an alternative. I can't eliminate racist imagery, but I can make an alternative. And if I can get an alternative to be in a place that has some authority to it, that is something that that decision makers pay attention to broaden there, because everybody is socialized in the same way, but to broaden some people's understanding of what this community could be like, then to me, that was my mission, that was my goal. And that's how I've always approached this, trying to show what is positive, what is worthy of respect, what is our humanly best, and capture that in images, and then to put it not only for white people to see, but most importantly, put it for us to see, because we are what we consume, as Elijah Muhammad says. So we need to see positive images of ourselves. We need to see possibility. We know we're not, we need to see that we're more than niggas and we're more than hoes and bitches. So that begins to ignite something else. We have to raise our image of ourselves. So to me, my primary market has always been my people. My secondary market has been my neighbors, people who can appreciate what I do. But I do it and I approach it and I make it for my people. At Tuskegee, I learned what I could from Mr. Polk. He demystified the process of shooting, but I knew that I did not have the ability to learn how to make compelling images. I did not have photo linguistics training. So I came to New York in the summer of 69, between my junior and senior year. And I went to a newsstand and I picked up all the magazines that treated photographs lovely, big spreads. Then I looked to see who was a picture editor on the masthead. And I called each one of them up and I said, look, I'm a student from Tuskegee. I want to be a photographer. But, you know, there are no schools that teach photography. You have to learn on the mentors. Then I would say, let me back up. I'm not calling you looking for a job. But I'm calling you because I know that all the best photographers have to see you. And I want you to look at my work and tell me what's the gap. Because I'm looking for a teacher. So I went to several places. People tried to be nice, but I figured out something very quickly that most picture editors are not photographers. And one day I'm sitting in the photo editor office at Look Magazine, Sam Young, young man, completely, you know, over his head. He cannot talk images to me. But it was quite fortuitous that this short old guy stuck his head in the door and he looked at Sam. And he says something to Sam, and Sam straightened up, which told me that was Sam's boss. And then he finally, before leaving, he looks at Sam, and he said, well, what's this? Who's this? So Sam said, well, this is this student from Tuskegee. He wants to learn how to be a photographer, blah, blah. So the guy says, well, when you finish with him, you send him into my office. So he closed the door. I look at Sam. Sam looks at me. We both know we're finished. So Sam said, well, you go out the door, turn right, go to the end of the hall, and that's Mr. Rothstein's office. I said, okay, I don't know who this guy is, but, you know, he tells me to come down. So I sit down in his office. He says, okay, what's on your mind? I said, well, I don't like the negative image of my people in the media, and I want to make images that changes that. So he sits back in his chair. He says, well, that's a pretty big what? I said, yeah, but it's the only one I have. Yeah. So he said, well, okay, let me see what you do. So I give him a few prints that I have brought up with me. He starts to look at them. And then immediately he takes out four pieces of paper and he starts shifting it around the print. He was doing what I learned that day is called cropping. So then he calls me over each after he crops one. He says, come look at the picture. I said, wow. It was a great picture. I said, did I make that? He said, yeah, but you didn't know it. And he didn't know it because you have all this other stuff competing with it and weakening it. And I said, okay, can we do another? Can we do this? So we must have done this for an hour. And then I said at the end of it, and my head is bursting with all these new concepts of composition, design,
you finally learned balance, it in ways that you content. Hadn't before.
The spirit had brought me a teacher. Had delivered me into a teacher. I sincerely believe the spirit is in charge. My pure devotion to my mission had put me in line with a teacher. So that process of with that man happened every day for that whole summer. He would send me out to shoot. He would give me film. He would process the film. He wouldn't make prints. He only did contacts because he taught me, I want to see how you develop a thought. For the whole summer, I learned from this man visual thought. I learned how to see. And with that, I went back home and I finished a book, my first book project, Black Women. I remember my father, who did not raise me, worked as an editor at Johnson Publishing, Jet and Ebony. And one of those editors came down for Black World, Hort Fuller, at Tuskegee, because we had a lot of people who would come and give talks. Malcolm X came, everybody. So Hort and I are having a talk, and Hort says, well, Chester, what do you want to do? Because it's important, you know, you have to have a mission. I said, well, Hort, I want to make an encyclopedia of images on the life and times of people of color, Black people. He said, well, he says, Chester, that's pretty big. He said, if you had to break it down and start off with one bit, what would you start out with? What would you like most? I said, well, I guess I like women. Well, he said, okay, good. Do women first. So that year I did a portfolio of women, and I was able to find a publisher so that when I finished school, actually my first book came out a few months later. And then I went after one of my second or third trip to Africa, I came out with another book on Black men called Drums of Life. My first trip to Africa was 71 because I went there on an assignment from Essence, and I went to Senegal. And I kept going back every year since. In fact, the summers of 72 and 73, I lived for the complete summers in Ghana, hitchhiking across the country, living in villages, attaching myself to the people who became friends. And in 74, I went to Senegal, where they speak French, as part of an exercise to compel myself. You know, one of the things about photography and what we do is that, you know, we want to make an image, but we don't want to disturb the process. But you have to acknowledge people's space, and you have to have their permission. So I use, probably like a lot of photographers use, nonverbal communication. Physical language of the body to make contact, to acknowledge a person's presence and ask for permission. And I thought I was pretty good at it, but I decided to really challenge myself and see if I was really good by going to a country where I could not speak the language, where the language was French and Wolof. And we Americans, you know, we don't speak anything except English. And I made it through. I didn't get my ass kicked, so I thought I did pretty good. And I made a lot of compelling images. Compelling imagery has always been my thing. How do I make a compelling imagery that when you see it, it burns into your consciousness, and there's something about it that stays there as you go along? There's a universality about it. There's a spirit to it. There's a subject to it. There's my approach to it. All of these things. Because what goes together to make a compelling image?
There was a lot in there, right? And I love when, you know, certain guests give their story, but there's always these like interesting gaps in the story that I like to try to fill out, because I know you started out as your story from the perspective of being a student at Tuskegee, right? So you have to be like in your late teens, right? But I want to know a little bit more about who was Chester Higgins before you realized you were interested in photography, and who was like the little boy in Alabama growing up in that family, and what made you care about the image of Black folks that was hanging up on the wall. So I wonder if we can rewind a little bit and sort of fill some of those gaps, right? I know I heard your presentation on B&H, and you mentioned that there was an experience that you had when you were a child that stuck with you, that sort of that influenced you to become, you know, the photographer that you are. Do you know that experience that I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a great idea to unpack things as we go along. Yeah, but I came from a very political family and a very educated family. My mother was a school teacher. My father was a small business owner. My grandparents were small business owners, and a minister whose house got burned out by the Klan because my grandfather was paying the voting fees for farmers to vote. So in that community, and my grandfather also provided the land and built the first school in my county for Black children to go to. So I come from a very civically involved, politically involved, and very loving family. At the age of 9, I had this apparition one evening. I was asleep. Something woke me up. It was a sound, but the sound wasn't in the air. It was in my head. And I opened my eyes. I sat up because in my room, one wall in my room had a big white circle in it in the middle of the night. And it wasn't coming from the light. It was just there. And in that circle, the middle opened up and there was this Black man standing in a very, meditative, peaceful way, with his hands up, palm up, dressed in what we see as togas, Greek Roman toga like fabric. And you know, I don't know what this means. I'm a kid. I'm 9. I just got here. I don't know if this is what happens in this place. There was nothing about it that seemed ominous. It opened its eyes, and then it started to walk toward me, and a crackling energy in the room from this particular point on. And then I heard in my head that it said it had come for me. And at that point, I freaked because I didn't know much about religion and stuff, but I heard that there was the angel of death. And so I thought, oh my God, this is an angel of death coming for me, and I'm scared. That frightens me, but more so than that, it pisses me off, because in my mind I'm saying, well, shit, what the fuck? I just got here. I'm only 9. I gotta die already. So I screamed, and my parents and grandparents came into the room, and they had this chain of light hanging from the ceiling, and somebody turned it on, and that thing went away. And my mother and everybody's holding my hand and kneeling at my knees with this question on her face, the alarm. And then I began to experience an ascension. I began to experience that they were getting smaller, that I was moving above them. But whatever my mother kept doing, it worked and it brought me back. And crying through my tears and responding to a question, I told them what I told you. And everybody was dumbfounded except my grandfather. But there was something that happened when I was ascending. I somehow glimpsed that there was like a different, not a super highway, but different lanes of reality. Mm. Traveling alongside, parallel to each other, that it was a busy world, just somewhere. And I had glimpsed that when I came back, and I didn't realize, but it began to change how I saw things. I began to study things a lot closer than I used to. And this had nothing to do with photography. This is just how I was changed, because I had a chance to get a peek that life and reality as we see it is not all that we look at. You know, our senses bring us a lot of stuff, but our senses don't bring us those other frequency lanes that I glimpsed when I had that out-of-body experience. So somehow it caused me to see stuff. You know, you can see things from a short view and a long view, says my great uncle Foth. It allowed me to see the short but it also gave me distance. And that distance allowed me to look at the thing that was behind it, the two of them together. And I wasn't spooked by it because, you know, it was something that my mind had realized, so that I knew I could not explain to anyone, but when I became a photographer, realizing I'd become this kind of person with that sort of perception, fed into my photographs, because my photographs are what you see is what the viewer is meant to see. But what you see is the beginning point for me. I'm looking at what's obvious in front of you, but I'm also looking at what's behind it, what's pulling the strings. Mm-hmm. And I find that I see that when a moment turns a corner. What I mean is, you're looking at me, we observe anything, and we're used to seeing it straight on, and we're used to seeing it in a continuous loop, so to speak. But continuality is broken up into bits, for lack of a better term, and those bits are strung together. And I think that those bits, not only are they strung together from the front, but they individually turn, so that I look I find the evidence and the presence of the spirit when the moment makes a turn. And I call that looking for the signature of the spirit in everything that I do.
Mm. This is interesting to hear you speak so much detail about this experience that was very spiritual for you. And I don't think out of any of the guests I've had on the show, I've heard anybody relate their work to spirit as eloquently as you did, and something that has like influenced you with the camera for like your whole career. Earlier you mentioned that if the photographer hates you, then they can't make a good image of you. And if the photographer loves you, they will make sure they present you in like a loving light. And it sounds like that experience allowing you to see the connection between these different parallel spiritual lanes. Like I rock with that 100%. Like I do feel like there are several different experiences happening at the same time. And sometimes we can pull from one spiritual experience and bring it to the next. And then you can grab something from over here. And it's like this interchanging of energy that's happening, right? I believe in that. But it is hard to describe to somebody who hasn't had a similar experience. So I hear what you're saying, and it makes a lot of sense. And I think it's beautiful to witness it in your images, because we're going to go into some more of your images, but I think it's beautiful to witness in your images because you see the consistency across, you know, from one image to the next. Piggybacking off of that, the last point you made about, you know, being a child 9 years old and feeling like, ah, shit, man, I just got here, right? You're taking me away already. You know, that experience as a child, right, that sort of led to the way that you approach your photography. You know, you were frightened by that experience, but it led you to start creating beauty in the world. And I see images like this. There's this innocence of this child, right? Like, how did that experience sort of start to craft how your eye saw the world in regards to how you decided to document it?
There's two things happening. How I structure a photograph has to do with my eye being trained in visual linguistics. Mm-hmm. The moment I make the photograph has everything to do with my spirit coupling with the spirit that I'm looking at.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When the presence of the spirit, that of the thing that I'm looking at, presents itself, that determines when I press the shutter. Mm-hmm. My visual linguistics determine which way I'm looking. But the moment that the photograph needs to be made is determined by the spiritual signature of what I'm looking at, when the spirit reveals itself. So in this picture, the spirit is revealing itself. The most obvious thing that pulls you is this sense of glee, mm-hmm. the sense of innocence, this sense of timelessness, this sense of balance, but the between balance and imbalance. It's just a free moment, like a bird flying. Mm-hmm. That is what the spirit, that is the spirit. That is a moment that the spirit presents itself for me. And that's what makes, so I'm always trying to combine the visual linguistics, which is a conscious thing, and the spirit signature, which is an unconscious thing. I'm trying always to make a sandwich of those two things.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
It does. It does. So I know sometimes with photography, especially in certain moments, I know for me, I'll go out and make images, and then I'll come back and start to look at the images. And sometimes I forget that I actually made certain images because I was so like in the zone. I was so tapped into what was happening. How do you feel like you, are you able to be present in the moment, even being a photographer? Like, are you, at what point are you focused more on, you know, documenting that moment as spirit guides you versus experiencing the moment for what it is, like experiencing the pure joy that this young boy is having?
Oh, I do all of that. You know, and, you know, when I was coming up, we had a Kathiaprasanna, the decisive moment. How you use yeah. all of these different skills, all of these different tools. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things I was taught by my mentor at Look Magazine is that before you press the shutter, you make 100 different decisions as a photographer. Mm-hmm. You made the decision about composition, design, balance, lighting, subject matter, time mm-hmm. of day, all of these. But you know, in order to make it work, you need to work on each individual tool at a time. Mm-hmm. That's what visual linguistics is about. So that once you find yourself in a situation, the mind just starts eliminating what needs to be eliminated, and deal on the ones that pertain, and you zip through it. So in that zip throughing it, I think all of us feel this sense of ecstasy that, my God, this is it. It's really happening. You know, I got it. You know, it's yeah. speaking to me.
Yeah.
I'm working it. We all want those moments because not every moment gives you that. Kathiaprasanna said that, you know, if he gets 5 images out of a contact sheet of 36, he's doing good. Mm-hmm. So starting off, I remember, you know, I could get 1, I could get 2, I get 3. You know, it's just that building up that confidence, doing it over and over, because fundamentally a photographer is an observer. But yeah. we are obviously a keener observer than everybody else because we can look at everyday things that people see and ignore, and we can see the gem of an image inside of it. So as we apply our skills of delineating stuff, that gem becomes more and more polished because of what we can our skills to see and bring it out.
Yeah,
the camera is
an
tool.
Extension of our.
It's an extension of you.
Absolutely.
Of your thinking, because the eye is in control. My first mentor taught me that. Like, there's no camera or lens that can make a picture. Only your eye can make a picture. The camera is an extension. It can be anything. It can be a box camera. It can be an expensive camera. It can be an iPhone. It has nothing to do with what you see, because you're the one that's controlling what it should see. You're the one that's controlling it to make it serve you, not the other way around. Mm-hmm. Now, here's a picture in Ghana. I love early morning light, and I love early afternoon light. Photographers call it the golden light. But I like it because it's the energy, the first energy or the last energy of the day of the sun. And I like the angle on which the sun is hitting the earth. You know, it's that 30-degree angle. I really love that light. And here, I'm walking on the beach early morning, and I see this father. I watched him. He was demarcating in the sand a square. You see it with his hands or his foot, I forget now. Mm-hmm. And then he had his son sit down in front of him. And then he had a Bible in his hand, and he put it to the son's head, and he begins to pray over him. Now, this picture could have been shot, you know, from other angles, isolated in itself. It's, you know, you don't know if the seated boy is a statue or what, but you notice something is going on between that head of that father and that expectancy that's going on in his body. And then I wanted to bring in, and the sun is almost over his head. And I wanted, because you can see the shadows of he and the sun sitting down. I do a lot of shooting into light advance my depth of field. And then I saw this guy in the background heading out to the water. And for me, he broke the space just right. It didn't take away from the tension. It broke the space and allowed the eye then to appreciate this other part of the picture, which is the water itself, the water in the sky. Mm-hmm. But these are the kind of moments that that I find and I isolate and I just work it.
Yeah. And I love the fact that you have like the silhouette, like all the figures in the background. I count at least four figures in the background. The one figure that's in the water, then the one that looks like they're dancing or that whatever movement they're doing, it looks like they are extremely happy. Then there's just a figure standing in between the father and the dancing figure. Then there's one all the way to the left that just is just there. And that just gives a lot more depth to the image. And it feels like you know, the moment you waited for that moment to kind of all come together, and you timed it right, you know. So it gives a lot of, you know, extra information to this image.
And I'm very much into music. I'm very much into jazz, and I like to find the music in our life, the music in a moment, and all those things.
You like to make the image dance?
Yes. I mean, because life is based upon frequencies. Everything that exists is existing on a frequency. And what does a frequency do? It dances. Mm-hmm. So being able to look at that and incorporate that, I'm interested in the fullness. Here's another one, silhouette again, father and son relationship.
So I just wanted to say something real quick. The reason why I put these two images next to each other is because I felt like there was a lot of similarities. You know, it was here you have the father and son on the left, sort of silhouetted, and you have a lot of information in the background to give us a sense of space. And then in this image is very similar. And, you know, to me, it felt like, you know, if I was looking at these two images without knowing who you are, without speaking to you, in my mind, this tells me the kind of images that the photographer is looking to make. This is the type of moments that you want to make, that you want people to see. There's a certain kind of emotion that you want us to feel when we see your work. So when I see those two images back to back, in my mind, it feels like there's a consistent message in what you want people to take away from your images.
Thank you. And, you know, we all reflect our lives, and this was a, and I identify with these two pictures for another reason, because at the time, I think it was 73, I had a daughter, but then my son was born. So, you know, this, mm-hmm. these rituals that we have, that fathers have with their children, that I was also looking for.
Absolutely. You know, similarly, I didn't grow up with my father, but I am a father now, and I have a son. And I look for these moments as well. Maybe it's because there's something that I was missing growing up. So I look for those, and as a way to sort of feel the joy between, you know, the father and son, as a way to kind of remind me of the joy I feel with my son, but also giving my younger child, my younger boy self, that feeling that I never had, right? So I resonate with these. Even when I watch movies and I see father-son, you know, moments in movies or in television shows, I get emotional seeing those, because I feel like that was a part of my life that I wish I had access to. I resonated with these images. So I know you connect a lot of your work to spirit and nature, right? You mentioned like the experience that you had as a child, you know, and the way you speak about light is you started talking about the sun being at a certain angle hitting the earth. And that's one aspect of looking at light that is completely related to nature, whereas a lot of other photographers, we may speak about light specifically from the technical standpoint, but you're speaking about light from the natural standpoint. And I think that is really interesting. When did you develop an appreciation and a respect for nature, you know, and how do you engage with nature now as a photographer?
Well, first of all, as a youngster, I lived in the country. So walking through woods, fishing, hunting, you realize that nature is alive. Light is very much alive. Light, as you learn more about it, is the single most important force in the universe because of the sun. The sun heats up the air. Heats up the water that gives us atmosphere. If the sun went out for a week, we'll all freeze to death. I'm so much into light that I refer to light as my mistress. Because that girl and I, we work together. I'm always, the first thing I do before I even before I even lift my camera is I see where the light is. And I make a decision about where I want to be in relationship to the light. This I learned from visual linguistics. That's how I lay down, a painter paints the canvas, how they want to do it. They lay down or do a primer. My primer is, where is the light? And where do I want to be in relation to the light? And then everything else begins to build on top of that. So here, you know, you have these kids in Ghana, as kids would do, playing in the surf. That Atlantic Ocean is a powerful one on the West Coast. On the East Coast, it's a lot more tame. But here you have these kids being kids, playing in this very dangerous surf. Daring it, and they want to be sprayed by it, but they have to protect themselves and not be caught by it. So I'm just like watching them be them, but I'm watching. So there's three elements of nature here. There's a human element. There is the rock element. There's a water element, and there's an air element, and there's a light element. So all of these coming together, to me, is what is always what I'm looking for. And this is how I use it. So I'm using, I'm using the light as a backlight, because there you get, you're getting, or it's a side light, actually. You know, you can tell what a light is by looking at the shadows. And just letting this moment fly, letting that moment run, and catching the transit of it and catching the music of it.
Beautiful. What up, y'all? I hope you're enjoying this conversation so far. We do our best to bring up as many dope artists as possible, and we do that with your support. And here are a few quick ways you can show some love. One, share and promote the episode with your people. Only takes a few seconds, and if you dig it, chances are your people are going to dig it as well. Two, subscribe at youtube.com/@BOKShutter. Stay updated on all the new content. All right, y'all. We appreciate you. Now it's back to the show. Peace. You know, I back in 2016 to 2017, my family, we lived in Ghana for about 8 months. I was out there on a project.
Oh, wow.
I was in Accra. Yeah.
That's the same.
Accra. I just saying.
Okay. With the Ga people.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you enjoyed chop? Ghana chop?
What's Ghana chop?
Food. Chop. Go have chop, 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 chop.
Oh, see, they may have changed the name. They weren't referring to it as chop when I was there. But yeah, definitely okay. Enjoyed it. Definitely enjoyed it. And there was one point where we were at the beach and this young boy was hanging out by me and my family, and my wife would go in and out of the water. And he came up to my wife at one point and said, "Be careful of the water. It will swallow you." Right. And he was referring to how
powerful. That means they have had a strong current.
Yes.
Currents are.
The water will swallow you.
Yes.
Right. And she was like, okay, yep. Thank you. So she came back and was like, all right, we got to watch out there, right? Because we saw what he was talking about. There's not a lot of people. There's no lifeguards. Yeah. It's none of that. It's just you and the elements, right? So definitely had to be mindful and of that, it because that water is very strong.
Very strong. And, well, did you have any palm wine while you're in Ghana?
I did. I had palm wine and I forgot this drink that was like really strong ginger. It was alcoholic.
Yes, yes.
I forgot what it was. It wasn't palm wine. I forgot what it was. But I had Sobolo, it's like sorrow.
Okay.
I had that drink. Yeah. I miss it out there. I have friends out there still, so definitely looking to get back out there, you know?
Good, good. Well, you know, in May is the Silver Jubilee of the Ashanti, of the Asante Henny.
Mm.
In Kumasi.
Kumasi, yes. Are you going back out there?
Yeah. I can't. I wanted to. My friend had called me the other day to invite me, but I have something I have to do here. I can't make that turnaround. I'm too old.
I get it. I mean, but to have visited 50 times, 50 plus is amazing. I mean, I remember when the wheels hit the floor, like hit the ground as we were landing, I just broke down in tears. I mean, I don't even know what time it was. It was dark, but I just remember the wheels touching the ground in Ghana, and I just burst into tears, man. Because that was my first experience.
It's an emotional.
Yeah, 100%. 100%.
Yeah, it's emotional.
So, mm-hmm.
You're home.
Mm-hmm. And that's what they were saying when I got off the plane. Yeah, when I got off the plane, they were saying, "Welcome home. How long have you been away?" And I was like, "Forever." But I'm here.
And they mean it. And the Ghanaians mean it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was a great experience. And, you know, I see similarities in, like, this photo you have. I'll share with you after. But this photo you have, I have a whole series of Yemiya women doing a tribute dance to her. And I saw this image and I was like, wow, this looks so similar to something that I made. So I'll share that with you after. But in regards to this photo, you know, I'm interested in the conversation, you know, between the human and the inhuman, you know, spirituality, you know, like what is our connection to spirituality and how you're able to bring that out in photography. But how do you know when you are in the presence of it, when you're seeing something? Like, what does something happen to you physically? Does something happen to you like silently? Like, what is that indication that something within the spiritual realm is speaking to you and calling you for you to go document it?
Okay, well, there's a fundamental difference how I and everybody else approach life.
Mm-hmm.
We all are conditioned to approach life from a human-centric point of view. Because of my apparition, I approach life from a spirit-centric point of view. Life, to me, is not something that humans are on top of. Life, to me, is something that the spirit is the foundation. Everything exists because of the spirit. What I'm looking at, everything is a spirit. Whether it's a tree, whether it's a goldfish, a man, a woman, a baby, everything to me is an expression of the spirit. I take the ego out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you have ego in it, then the person or the thing is more important than the spirit. I do the reverse. Because I know that whatever, it's kind of like popcorn. I know that it's rising, it's there, but there's something underneath that's pushing the popcorn up that it has, that is in charge of the popcorn. And I am always looking for what is in charge of pushing the popcorn up. The popcorn being what we see, what our ego gives a name to. I don't believe an elephant knows his name is elephant. So here she is communicating with her spirit through dance,
mm-hmm.
through her twisting and turning. Look at the lekes on her. She is a priestess. The lekes, the necklaces.
Mm-hmm.
She is a priestess. She is purifying herself in that movement, in the air. And I'm attracted, and her eyes are closed. And she's being able to launch herself into this feeling that nobody else can see and feel but her. And I'm just trying to capture that combination of what's going on and not to intrude in it, but just as it passes by me, take a shot of it. I can make this picture only because she exists,
mm-hmm.
only because she's in that space of spirituality that exists. If she did not exist, this picture wouldn't happen. So I'm thankful that she exists and I'm witnessing it. That's all I'm ever doing with my pictures. I'm just being a witness.
The observer.
Yeah, the observer, but a witness is a little more an observer because an observer is more detached. A witness has has a connection to it, where the observer does not have to have a connection.
Witness sounds a little bit more active, observer a little more passive.
Yeah.
Indeed. So I like that concept of, you know, seeing everything as spirits. I know there's a famous quote or belief that we're not humans having a spiritual experience with spirits having a human experience, right? So the body is just the spirit embodying this physical form. It's like a vehicle, like a car, right? That we get to occupy for a little bit. But the essence of the body is the spirit. And the more we're able to tap into that essence, the more we're able to, you know, see our similarities. We're able to pick up on, you know, silent energy, you know, and that's really big. That's really important. You know, when I saw this image, I just felt like this is just a very, very striking photo. It stops you in your tracks. For the technical reasons, just like the contrast of her deep black skin with this white cloth and all you see, and then the contrast of her eyes, the dark pupils around the whites of her eyes, and just like it's like this crescent shape, you know, that is revealing her eyes. It's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful photo. I know that you studied, I know when you got to New York and you were working with the editor, Rothstein, right? He was teaching you how to how to, you know, make better images, how to see the image within the image. But how did you learn how to photograph strangers? Like, how were you able to see this woman and make this beautiful portrait of her?
Well, I'm a gregarious guy, number one. And, you know, photographing people, I've learned a couple of things. You have to be very clear with people what you're interested in. And I tell people, and fundamentally, you have to love people and let them know that you love them. And not have judgment. The photographer in me saw this image in terms of composition, positive and negative space. The spirit in me saw the soul in her eyes. And that became the sandwich. Now, in making pictures, because I lived in parts of Africa that Islam is very prevalent, I know the protocol about photographing women. You can photograph the men easily, but photographing the women is shunned upon. So when I saw this woman, I would have been prepared to show the utmost of respect, to ask her for her photograph. But she was with a husband and a son. So I knew the protocol meant I had to ask him. Not if I could photograph his wife, but ask him if I could photograph his family. And once I set them all up, sitting her in a spot that was the light, the natural light would work, I photographed the group, I photographed him, I photographed his son, and then I photographed the mother, singularly. So having a knowledge of the protocol made this picture happen.
So culturally, there was a hierarchy.
Yes, there was a hierarchy. And I learned this because my first trip, my first summer in Ghana, I had received a grant from the Ford Foundation. I wrote this proposal to look at a society in transition. It's the point where you go into a village and some people have a lock on their doors and most people don't. And I went to several people to be my sponsors. One was Cornell Kappa, then Margaret Mead, and then a head of anthropology at Columbia University, this black man named Elliot Skinner from the islands. And he had been an ambassador in Africa. And I go into Elliot's office and Elliot and I are talking. He says, so you want to go to Africa to photograph the culture, the people? He says, well, how are you going to do that? Because you're not African. You know, he was completely right. But, you know, I laugh because it's the kind of thing that white people say to you, white missionaries say to you. Mm-hmm. If I say, you know, you have nothing in common with them as they take the next flight over themselves. But no, Elliot was saying, okay, look, in order for you to really understand and get the most out of this trip, you're going to have to learn to think how the African thinks. You're going to have to learn his culture because you're going to walk into a yard of a person's house and you're going to be completely oblivious to everything they believe in because you have an American mindset. So you got to learn that that little pot that's sticking over there that look like it means nothing has a big meaning. And you got to learn what it is. And you got to learn that that thing that's hanging from the tree has a meaning. And you got to know what it means. Mm-hmm. Because that becomes the foundation of your conversation. And then conversation, connection to people, understanding of them, and no judgment then becomes the bridge that you need to form to be able to have them open up and share and be comfortable with you. Mm-hmm. So, that was a very important lesson. I never forget. He was right. And I learned a lot from that.
While my time in Ghana was very welcoming, there was a cultural disconnect in the beginning because I didn't know what to do, what to say. You know, there was just things that I had to learn. You know, I had to sort of cleanse myself of my American experience to now be in, you know, this new country with new customs and culture and, you know, language. You know, even though English was a main language, there's nuances within it, right? So I had to, it took a while to kind of shed, you know, my, you know, American, you know, experience to kind of now adapt the Ghanaian experience. And it wasn't until I started to leave that I felt like now I'm starting to feel a lot more grounded. Then that's how life works sometimes, right? Like, as soon as you start to figure it out, it's like on to the next thing. But there was this moment where I realized like, yeah, just because I'm black, phenotypically dark skin, doesn't mean that I can just walk into a new culture like I belong there, I have full range to do what I want. Like, that's not how it works. You still have to respect the culture and understand the nuances of that culture, you know?
So you're discussing the issue of acclimation.
Mm. Yeah.
Now, let me tell you something about our African cousins. All of them speak three languages. They speak their mother's tongue. Sometimes if their father's tongue is different, they speak the father's tongue. They'll speak the neighboring tribal or nationality's tongue, and then they'll speak the official tongue. This is just how they are. That's why they do so well in all universities. They're smart as hell. And we do a disservice to ourselves when we think just because they're African that they're stupid, because we're looking at them through the white man's judgment of us, who has spent their whole life in all the institutions that keep us from thinking. In this country, they teach us just enough to make me think we learned something, but not enough to question what we have learned.
Yeah.
Big difference. And these kids, these African kids get that. And they come and they excel because of it. When I was at Tuskegee, we had African students. They were in the sciences. And it's those students that I made friends with that turned me on to my first African writers, to the works of Haile Selassie, the works of Kwame Nkrumah, the work of Ezekiel. And I began political biographies. And that's how I began to learn Africa, by reaching out. And the music is incredible. Fela Ransom Kuti, all of those guys. Mm-hmm. And that's why when I go to Africa every year, I look forward to the music, which has now become Afro pop, which is Afro beat, but it's Afro great beat. Music. You know, Afro beat is great music. Here, you know, rap is, unfortunately to me, is a lot of noise. In the beginning, rap was conscious, but then it got corrupted and it just came noise. But luckily for me, there's jazz, which comes out of this culture. And lucky for me, there's Afro beat. But taking those two and then ignoring the rap is what has maintained my sanity. Because the rap is almost as racist as the kind of photographs I was trying to get away from.
Well, I think it's the mainstream hip hop that the media has started to control the narrative of, and what is most widely heard, like on radios and on TV. I think that has sort of taken a turn in a negative direction, but there's still a lot of good hip hop that's just below the surface and that is, you know, conscious minded. But it's just, you know, you have to do the work to find it, which is unfortunate. Like, the stuff that has like more positive messages, more political awareness, you know, is not easily accessible. You know, we have to do some digging for it, you know, and that's unfortunate. It's the same like with, you know, my photography experience. I was only getting, you know, white photographers. I have to do the digging to find and discover, you know, black photography, you know. So hopefully one day that changes. That's sort of what this platform is about, is putting, you know, folks like yourself and other artists that we've had conversations with, like bringing it to the forefront to make it easier to discover all the work and experiences that and contributions that we've made in this craft, you know?
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
So now you're looking at this picture early morning in Harlem. There again, the 30-degree, 40%, 40-degree light, and that early morning cup of coffee and cigarette at a local coffee shop. Get that sandwich. It's what, you know, urban dwellers do. And it's near it's uptown Harlem. But it's a certain kind of a, you know, when you live alone, there's a certain kind of, you have to find a way to make yourself comfortable with yourself. Being out with anybody doing something makes a difference. But there's a difference between solitude and loneliness. And here I thought I was capturing, solitude, and then the guy outside, another alone person, but everybody moving in there, but moving in a space. When I was growing up, one of the things my great uncles taught me was that there's a rule of 12s when you're approached by a stranger to size up the situation. The first thing is 12 feet away. Watch how they enter space. Do they enter space in a very confident, assertive way or insecure way? That tells you something about the person, how they solve a problem of navigating. Number two is when they are close enough for you to, 12 inches enough for you to smell, how do they take care of that body? How do they feel that body is entitled to? And the third thing is the first 12 words out of their mouth. How do they string a thought? And that tells you everything that you need to know about anybody.
Wow. And that's something that you've believed since you've heard it?
I grew up with it. It's a part of me. So it's not something I have to think about.
12 feet
but
is
I
how
use
somebody
it
enters
I use situation. It when I shoot. 12 feet. How does a person enter their space?
Mm-hmm.
Into their space. How do they navigate space?
Mm-hmm.
How do they smell?
Interesting.
And how do they think?
Mm-hmm. So what was the situation with this gentleman?
Well, he's moving purpose. The guy outside in his movement, that's a very purposeful movement that he's making.
Mm-hmm.
That suggests a certain level of confidence.
Mm-hmm. And the gentleman sees it?
He's moving with the leg. He's moving with his leg extended, not with his knees bent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The man extended is occupying his space. He's comfortable in his space. That's why it's solitude to him. And he's, you know, who knows what he's thinking, but he's thinking something. I'm more comfortable with people who think than people who don't. So I find those people. Mm-hmm. I'm attracted to them.
So I know that you worked for the New York Times for a number of years, I think around 4 decades.
Years. Yeah.
Close to 4 decades.
Yep.
Amazing, right? As a staff photographer. I wonder if you can describe that environment for you, like as a Black male photographer during that period. Like how were you able to work in a professional setting while still bringing your spirit-based style of photography into that setting?
I just did it. I just stayed consistent. Mm-hmm. You know, the thing is that people weren't, they wanted to see the goods, so to speak. As long as I produced the goods of the image that captured the information that they were interested in, that's all they saw. Anything on top of that was extraneous. Because, you know, when I'm talking about what I'm, you know, you didn't know what I was doing until I told you. It didn't affect your appreciation of the picture. It didn't affect their appreciation of the picture. Just because I load it with something else is something that I do. Mm-hmm. So to me, the spirit put me in that place so that one, I could bring in a more positive, intelligent view of Black life, and so that I can also add a spiritual component to it for those who can understand it. I tell people that, you know, when you look at my images, the idea is to make it look simple so that it feeds the number one imperative. But because my images are not simple, they are layered with information. If you know more about that culture or more about what you're looking at, you would then know what you're looking at. But you don't have to know that to appreciate my pictures. But if you if you know that, you can deconstruct my images and you find out all these other layers of things that are in it, which will always be in it. And it depends upon the viewer what they extract from it. But it's there. Mm-hmm.
It's either you take it or leave it, right? This is who you are. This is the work that you make, and this is the place where you make your work from. You either rock with it or you don't.
Well, two things. When I first came to the Times, I remember one day one editor came back and he was looking at me. He says, "Well, I can't find anything." It's not that he couldn't find anything. Every picture was a great picture. He could not find what he was used to seeing about Black folks. Gordon Parks taught me a very important lesson. Mm-hmm. Gordon says, when I went to see him, he says, "Okay, Chester, I hear what you say you want to do. I'm looking at your books, your pictures. I like it." He says, "Now, when you get assignments from white editors, you go out to do it. You have 36 exposures on a roll of film. If you make 35 the way you're talking to me now and the way you've been working, and you slip up and you decide to make the 36 the way they look at things, that's the one they're going to use." So he says, never make that picture. Never give them the choice. They're going to be stuck with what you got.
Wow. And how did you receive that?
Hey, I just received it as a validation of how I was already doing. Mm-hmm. Just to keep going ahead, straight ahead. Essentially, essentially, I make them a co-conspirator in an issue that they have no idea what they're doing.
For this being the door of no return, and you being African American and visiting this part of West Africa where this door existed, what was this experience like for you?
Well, it was troubling because I'm visiting a place of all trauma. And that trauma is still inside of us. This door in this dungeon in the 1600s, a gangplank went out. And at that gangplank would be anchored boats. And the people would be loaded on those boats. So this particular door was the last piece of African soil that our ancestors would touch on the way to the Americas. So this door this space has been visited by spirits that have been in desperation, despair, torn away from their families, unsettled spirits have occupied this door, have touched this door, their spirits have left a mark onto this aperture that they have gone through. So my thing was, how do I put all that together that I'm feeling? the finality of it, the presence of it, that even the silhouette of the woman could be flapping in or out, as well as in the middle. It has time to it. And you see the expanse of the ocean out from it. It was a, I'm always thinking, how can I take something and photograph it in such a way that somebody who is not here with me can feel the power of the moment, the power of the place. So a lot of pictures of mine, you know, you can say it deals with people. And a lot of them deal with place. This picture deals with both at the same time.
Was this woman aware that you were making this image?
This woman is a woman in 1971 when I first visited Senegal. She was a travel guide. Her name was Madame Ba. I was working, taking my time, photographing in the dungeons, and I came out in the hallway and I saw Madame Ba just so relaxing in the doorway, except her feet were more directly underneath her. And I said, Madame Ba, please do one thing for me. Extend your feet to the other side of the door. She's a tall woman. She fills up this thing, but by extending her feet, there's air room or headroom over her. And that to me was the only thing that needed to be done. And that's the picture. Just keep doing what you're doing. I mean, just extend your foot.
I mean, it's a powerful, powerful photo. Definitely a traumatic place in the world, you know. But I think, you know, it communicates what you wanted to communicate. Like anybody who's familiar with this door knows it when they see it. And this was a great depiction of it, you know.
This is a man in the desert, in the Sahara. I think I made this in Mali. And, you know, I just love the contrast. I love the garment. They use these garments in the desert to wrap your face when a sandstorm comes up so it doesn't get in your eyes. And then it gets very cold at night in the desert. And you extend it out over your body to keep your body warm. But I'm also interested in the interior, the interiority of people, the interiority of people. So here he's inside of himself. And I'm just like following right in with him. Because the spirit is overarching over all of this.
I know you say when you're photographing faith, you have to check your identity because it can get in the way. And you just said you don't want to be a part of the picture. And I know a lot of photographers who, you know, naturally, right? We are the ones who are controlling the camera. A lot of us bring our own perspective into our work, into our images, but you work really hard not to bring yourself into it. So how do you check your identity when you're in those vulnerable situations where somebody is in tune with themselves? How do you not disturb that?
I have to move like water. I zen water. One of my mentors, Romy Bearden, led me down this path of finding your zen. And he said the reason why it's important is because if you're an archer and you're shooting at a target, you know, your ego, you're looking at it one way. But when you zen it, you're looking at the target, and when you and the target becomes one, that's when you release your arrow. You take it to another level. So he says you got to find your zen. What's your zen? And it has to be an element. So I started talking to other older photographers and say, well, do you have a zen element that you work with? And different people had different things. One photographer said, well, you know, I really sort of like become a wall and I photograph and things go past me. I head off at the pass. Another photographer said, well, I believe if I dress in this particular blue color, I'm invisible and I can go through. And I had to keep thinking about this for a couple months. And I finally realized that my zen is water. Why? Because if you imagine a brook of water, water coming down a brook, going over rocks, the water goes in and out and under, and it never disturbs the situation. It keeps flowing. See, I think that when disturbance comes is when we try to plant ourselves in a situation, as opposed to not having the egotistical need to be, but rather to be passing through and everything else is passing through. So when I photograph, in addition to all those other things we've talked about, I'm zenning myself as water to undisturb the moment. But I know how to take in the whole moment as well. But I do all of that. And you know, it's like, you know, if people know I've been there, I didn't do my job.
That means that your presence was too distracting.
Yes.
I like that. Flow like water. That's a Bruce Lee quote as well, right? Be like water, my friend.
Well, go, Bruce.
So, you know, this is one of the few images of yours that I found that was in color. You have a lot more images in color, but a lot of your work is in black and white. And I think with this image, you know, is when I first discovered your reference to light being your mistress. Since you have a whole body of work, like early career, where black and white was just the standard, right? How did you learn to start seeing your images, like photographically seeing your images in color versus like developing an eye for seeing and photographing in black and white? Like, how did that shift your process?
Well, I started in 69, the summer of 69, I did all black and white. And I came back in 70 with Look, and I started doing all color. And there was a couple of very good color photographers Look had, Joel Baldwin, who was fantastic, who approached color as in a very graphic way, essentially making posters out of your images. And I learned to shoot color and using filters, and I learned to shoot color from him. But I also love to backlight. And so this is a product of that. But color, I've always been, and I've shot color, but I never showed color, except these last two books I did, one called Ancient Nubia and one, the Sacred Nile book, which is all color. And the reason being is that, one, I always thought that black and white was a much purer form and was a much more effective form in showing human drama. And I still do. The thing about color, though, is that color is distracting. You can make the image, but the image can suffer because the color has distracted from the strength of the image. So I shoot color compositionally as black and white, so that I'm stripping away, and I'm being very controlling about how much of it you see, because I'm seeing the negative effect of color, not the positive effect of color. When people just see the positive effect of color, you get too much color. But when I'm editing color out to make sure it serves a, that it's only there because it serves a point, not because it can be there, then I think that's when I'm happier with it.
That's an interesting breakdown of color versus black and white. I find that, at least with the younger generation of photographers, I see a lot of black and white photos, and I feel like they want their photos to communicate what you just mentioned, as far as black and white being like a more simplistic way of conveying emotions. But I don't feel like, you know, they are photographing the scenes or the people with black and white in mind. There's no intention to make it black and white. It feels more like it's a post-processing thing where they just shift it to take the color out and make it black and white, as opposed to seeing photographically in black and white. Because when you see photographically in black and white, there is that simplicity. You are removing any distracting elements in the background so that it becomes like a very strong composition. But I see a lot of photographers convert the images to black and white, and there's all this distractions in the background that doesn't allow me to appreciate what it is that they're trying to communicate, you know? And so I'm happy to hear you break down that difference between how you photograph. I mean, you photograph the same for each, but the way you see color and present color is still in a very simplistic way. Do you feel like you can look at this image right now, that you can convert this image to black and white, and that it will still convey the emotion that you want it to?
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
I didn't thought about it like that, but that's how I shoot. I'm very intentional. Mm. So yes, it could. I mean, I have to tweak it, but you know, it's kind of like the picture. I don't know if you saw the picture I have of the man lying down in a boat, and the light is coming behind him.
Yes.
But I could do it. I didn't. It's very easy, you know, for me to say yes and to do it because I've shot it compositionally as black. And, you know, when you shoot compositionally, the picture is powerful if you can hang it upside down and it still hangs together. Mm-hmm. Then you've achieved a lock. I think this locks well either way.
Agreed. The yellow definitely does something for this image. This man in a cave with the backlight, and the yellow just gives it some sort of like a spiritual like presence. You know, it feels angelic in some ways, because it's just all this light emitting from behind them. So I wonder how it would look in black and white, but I do feel like the simplistic approach of using color in this situation really aids this particular photo. So James Baldwin, very, very interesting figure, you know, in our community, but not just our community, in the world, right? He's so highly respected. You know, how did you, you know, when I see this image and hearing you speak about your experience, you know, it lets me think about the differences in photography and how different photographers approach the craft. Some people are very technically sound, right? They understand all the mechanics of the camera and the film and all of that. Doesn't mean that they actually know how to make an interesting photo, right? But then there are others who are led by their inner voice, the spirit guides them. Photographers such as yourself, who sometimes you can't explain why you were led to make an image. It just happens to you. You have this connection, right? And I think about James Baldwin because he's always questioning the world, you know, through his work. You know, at this point in your career, you know, how would you say you have identified with your work, with the photos that you make?
Well, one of the things I was taught early on is that if you're going to photograph somebody, you know, professionally, we have to read the room, so to speak, read the subject whenever we're there. But there are always also get an advantage. And when you're dealing with artists, you have the advantage of being able to, if it's a writer, read what they write. If it's a musician, listen to what they their music is like. If it's a sculptor or a visual person, see what they do. At Tuskegee, my freshman year, freshman sophomore year, we had to read books of James Baldwin, Ralph Ellison, a whole group of people. So that gave me some inkling. And then I've read other writings of his, and I love, you know, his intellectual fortitude and insight. And I think this picture is my effort to try to look at, to reach inside of him for that, because that's what he, that's him. You know, I have to also say that personally, I thought James Baldwin was very, he is not a beautiful guy. But my mother told me when I was growing up that Mary McLeod Bethune was also not a beautiful woman. But when she spoke, when she elucidated her ideas, she became so beautiful. And I think the same can apply to James Baldwin. He's, this is a kind of picture that sort of transcends that that look that could be less than beautiful. I don't know how to say it, because it's an this is a picture from the inside of James Baldwin, as opposed from the outside of James Baldwin, and it captures, I think, his intellectual depth, and that's what I was after. But all of that's because, you know, I knew by reading him and by over the years, I knew that these other things, these other layers were there. And because of the spirit, I knew something else. And he has this spiritual experience as well as a young minister. So I tried to do something that I thought really captured his totality of his spirit and his intellect.
Beautiful. Amazing portrait. It definitely is a fitting portrait of him because of how, you know, how the complexity of his thoughts, but also the eloquence of how he delivers them. I feel like this portrait allows us to kind of see into a little bit more into who he is as a being, you know. So it's a very introspective image of him. So I thank you for creating it. I think I have one more question for you. Right here, you photographed the champ, right? I know that, you know, you mentioned that you look for the point where the obvious touches what you can't see. And, you know, with Muhammad Ali, you know, he dealt with a lot of public scrutiny regularly, you know. And a lot of times they say, if you want to be successful at something, you have to be willing to fail publicly, right? You have to go for something big. Like, you went to the Times and said, yo, I want to change the way that the media sees black people. And then I forgot what the other point was that you made. You want to change something. And they're like, well, oh, you want to make a catalog of just beautiful black people from across the world.
The Life and Times.
Those things are too, yeah, Life and Times, right? Like, those are too big. It's like, no, you have to think big. I have a poster over here that says think bigger, and the words bigger are like being cut off because they're like expanding beyond the frame, right? Like, we have to think big in order to, you know, create some of the things that we want. But yeah, you have to be willing to fail publicly, right? So what would you say in your you know, long and extraordinary career, like, what was some of the biggest obstacles that you had to face, and how did you overcome them?
You know, in the beginning, the obstacle was trying to convince my people that they should hire me, you know, for their jobs or whatever. And I discovered that, you know, black people don't really think you're good until white people think you're good. But, you know, that happens. But obstacles, you know, obstacles you have to look at as opportunities for learning. As my mentor, Romy Bearden, taught me that the greater the obstacle, the more creative you have to become to overcome them. So an obstacle is an opportunity. We are not owed anything. Nobody is owed anything. So you have to make your opportunities. You have to prepare for resistance, because resistance is going to come a lot more often than acceptance. So your belief in yourself and what you're doing, it means when you run up against opposition, you have to figure out another way to get around it. The obstacles are going to come. If you go through life without obstacles, that means I can tell you a person who went through life and did nothing. But everybody who did something had to overcome a lot of obstacles. That's just how it's a rite of passage. And you just have to accept it, embrace it, because it's forcing you to grow. It's forcing you to think, what do I have to change about myself? What do I have to change about my mission? What do I have to change about the person I'm talking to or dealing with? That's the only way your mind is going to deal with that question, because you ran into obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
But you got to see obstacles as a friend. That doesn't mean you got to like them. Nobody ever likes obstacles. My latest book, Filled in the Spirit, it took me 5 decades to do. Half of the time, I didn't know what I was doing, but I was driven by the spirit. You got to do this. That's interesting. Go do this. And then when I'm ready to publish it, all of the other publishers who published my other books, they've been so long ago, those people have changed. They're no longer there. I probably used 3 different agents over 3 years and got 30 rejections, if not 40, for that book. So the obstacle came to me that, look, this book is not going to happen unless you do it yourself. So then I had to learn what I went to always wanted from a publisher, to edit a book, to lay the book out, to find a printer, to find distribution. I had to overcome that obstacle. But it's the obstacle that taught me a new skill. And in this world, you've got to wear many different hats. One hat is not going to do it. If you think you got to wear one hat and get through, I have a bridge to sell to you. You have to wear many hats. You have to let those obstacles teach you. When you run into an obstacle, take it for what it is. Yeah, I'm disappointed. But then you have to say, what is the lesson that the obstacle is teaching me? Because that's what it's teaching you. And when you learn that lesson, then you can remove the obstacle.
Beautiful, man. Mr. Chester Higgins Jr., thank you so much for your time. Thank you for sharing your story, for talking us through your images and your approach to making images. I hope that, you know, people who tune in, you know, are able to, you know, tap into our spiritual side a lot more as we're making our work, because I think that's what's going to make our work more impactful. It's going to create more of the emotion that we want people to feel, and it's going to be more memorable. I think art without that personal connection is just kind of surface level. And I think I want us all to be able to make art that is more impactful, especially if we're focused on raising, you know, the level of energy that is emitted between, you know, the Black community, right? That's our goal. I think that hearing you talk about spirit is very, very important. So I appreciate everything that you shared with us today, man. Thank you.
My pleasure.
All right. Until next time, y'all. Thank you for tuning into the Black Shutter Podcast. We'll see you on the next episode. Peace. Yo, family, that's a wrap for this episode. Thank you for tuning in. We appreciate your support. Now, if you were digging this conversation, be sure to send the artist some love. Hopefully, some part of their experience inspired you to be a better artist and to be a better human. Be sure to follow us on youtube.com/@BLKShutter. On that note, we'll catch you in the next episode. Peace.